It's Wednesday, August 24th, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my Missouri School of Journalism colleagues, Mike McKean and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, yet another major shift in strategy for the Trump camp as he brings on two new higher-ups to run his campaign. And this is coming at the same time we find out that the campaign is still paying former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski. He, at the same time, is also picking up a paycheck from CNN. Gawker.com has gone dark. Univision bought the bankrupt media company and shut down its flagship site Monday. We'll talk about what this means for free speech, for audience engagement, and for the remaining properties that were once a part of Gawker Media. And the shoes, they make the woman. We'll talk about a St. Louis Business Journal feature, which asked some of the city's most successful businesswomen to show up to a photo shoot with the pair of shoes they felt most defined them. The best way to bring some personality to the feature? Maybe, maybe not. I'll ask Mike and Ernest what they think. There's a lot more hopefully we'll get to before our half hour's up, but let's start by talking about what's going on with WikiLeaks. It's an Associated Press report that has come out that indicates some pretty significant collateral damage in WikiLeaks' crusade to expose government secrets. Mike, we're learning that in its efforts, WikiLeaks has apparently compromised the privacy of hundreds of innocent people, many of them survivors of sexual abuse. We're talking about sick children, the mentally ill.
Yeah, and so a little background. WikiLeaks, as we all know, is this transparency site that takes a lot of government documents that they get from people such as Bradley Manning or maybe the Russians, and then they put them out there for everybody to look at. And what the AP story shows is that despite assurances from the WikiLeaks founder, Julian Assange, that they protect the privacy of ordinary citizens, that just isn't true. Either through negligence or because they don't have the staff to do it, they found examples, the AP has, of more than 500 cases where WikiLeaks has put out data about everything from passport information to health records of all sorts of innocent folks, mostly in Saudi Arabia, including teenage rape victims, people being outed for being gay. And, you know, basically, it's just saying that for whatever reason, WikiLeaks is doing this when it has assured people that it wouldn't do it.
So what is Julian Assange's his take on this been? Is he defending the action?
Well, I mean, so far, Julian Assange has not given any interviews, hasn't responded to requests for them. The only thing we've seen is on Twitter, under the WikiLeaks account, basically calling the story ridiculous and saying it's a rehash of a story that they did a couple of years ago, which isn't exactly true. So we don't really know how they're reacting, except to say that I think a lot of people would ascribe this to the sort of ends justifies the means, because WikiLeaks has been more and more radicalized and more partisan in what it has released. And maybe they just think that, you know, whatever it takes to get this information out there, we're going to do it, no matter if it hurts a few little people along the way.
Well, I think what's really hurting them is the fact that they had allies who supported their initiative to weed out corruption and use this data in a way that was going to basically help the little people that you're talking about, Mike. And now they're losing that support because it's having an impact on people who don't have the means to fight back against WikiLeaks or to do what the Saudi government has done, what the U.S. government has done, which is basically to put out their own press releases and do their own PR to say, well, wait a minute, WikiLeaks, it's fine that you're putting this information out there, but you're also damaging the national security of sovereign nations and others.
Yeah, it was just a few years ago when WikiLeaks was putting out, for example, the documents leaked by Bradley Manning, that they had the New York Times and they had the Guardian, they had the biggest publisher in Germany, lots of others who were not only working with them and doing stories based on these leaked documents, but the journalists were vetting the content and saying, hey, you probably shouldn't put this out there because it has this private information in it. Now those journalists aren't doing it because their relationship with WikiLeaks is soured, and so apparently nobody's doing it.
Yeah, I mean, what it does is it damages its credibility, and it it's Julian Assange, for all the problems that he has really built up some credibility among people who could take that information and try to do some good with it. And now they're going to have to spend time trying to make sure that all of these private information of individuals who can't sort of fight back is being dealt with. And that's just adding another layer to news organizations. And they're going to say, well, wait a minute, you know, I'm not going to use your information. I'm going to go get mine. And that hurts what WikiLeaks has tried to do from its inception.
You can't, you know, but help but wonder whether some of this has to be influenced by the fact that Julian Assange has been holed up in the Ecuadorian embassy in Great Britain for the past couple of years for fear that if he faces the charges in Sweden over alleged sexual assault, that he's going to get extradited to the United States. Although there was a story, I think, in the last week or so saying that the British government was finally going to allow the Swedes to come into the embassy and interview him there in Great Britain instead of taking him back to Stockholm. So I don't know. We'll see what happens.
Well, Mike, you and I were abroad last week. We were doing some professional training. And at one point we were in the classroom and I looked up to you and I said, oh my goodness, here's an alert. Univision has bought Gawker. We had known that the company had filed for bankruptcy and was looking for protection there. And it had literally been paralyzed following the judgment in the Hulk Hogan defamation case a few months ago. What seemed to us, this kind of felt like an unlikely buyer.
I guess so. But on the other hand, Univision has been buying up some other properties that you wouldn't have expected a Spanish language mm-hmm. network to buy up. I mean, they bought The Onion, the parody news site. They bought The Root, an African-American culture site. So they are trying to expand. And what seems to be the common denominator with those and the other Gawker properties yeah. is that they're targeted at millennials. And they have a very sort of unique sort of sarcastic personal voice to them that appeals to millennials.
Now, among the most sarcastic voices was the Gawker.com site, the flagship site within that media group. That was shuttered on Monday, completely shut down.
Well, I mean, they had to shut it down because I think what they're going to try to do is rebrand it, because Gawker sort of has this sort
stigma
of
now?
Stigma now yeah. and what happened with the Hulk Hogan case and others. And if Univision is bought that and now they're saying, okay, we want to make it a part of all of these other millennial targeted media operations that we have, we're going to have to rebrand it so that maybe it fits with those and it doesn't hang on to its old past.
I think it's really interesting to hear people argue in the media over whether Gawker was responsible for their problems or Peter Thiel, the Silicon Valley capitalist who financed the Hulk Hogan lawsuit, was responsible.
The question of, was Gawker murdered or did it kill itself?
And I guess my answer would be, I think Peter Thiel murdered them, but Gawker left a loaded gun on the bedside table that they picked up and shot him with.
I would agree with that. I mean, it left itself wide open for this to happen. And I think other sites along the same lines as Gawker has sort of figured it out and said, wait a minute, we're going to have to do a lot more vetting before we run any stories, any video, anything like this that's going
so
to open us up.
So perhaps a chilling effect for the better.
Well, it could be a chilling effect for the better. I mean, I've seen even some stories that have come out on TMZ, which is sort of seen as Gawker-like, that have actually had more facts in them than I've seen TMZ have in a long time.
I mean, I will say that Gawker has had some great writers. They've done some interesting things that have, you know, shown the way on how to do online journalism. But frankly, if you look at what happened in the Hogan case,
yeah.
not even so much just the facts of the case, but the editor for that story about Hulk Hogan was asked a question by the attorney. Remember that famous answer? He says, is there ever a time when a sex tape would not be newsworthy? And he says, well, yeah, if it involved a kid. Well, how old a kid? 4 years old. Ha, 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 ha. That kind of attitude, that arrogance, you know, at Gawker is, I think, what ultimately led to their downfall.
So what do we know or what can we infer at this point about what might happen with some of those other sites, perhaps Gizmodo, the tech site, or Deadspin, the sports site?
I think all of them are going to have to be careful about what they put up on their sites. I mean, it's just that simple, because if you have someone like a Thiel who mm-hmm. can raise that kind of, who has that kind of money,
yeah.
who can go after you in court and win a judgment, then that sort of stifles that kind of media operation or that kind of news going out there.
But Gizmodo, Deadspin, Jezebel, still in operation, not sunsetted the way that, that
and those Gawker are probably the more valuable of all those properties, even if Gawker.com wasn't so toxic right now, because those are very specifically targeted at demographics that Univision wants to pick up on. But I mean, Gawker had to go away as a brand, not only because of the lawsuit and the judgment against them, but actually Univision, as I understand it, wrote into their contract in buying out the Gawker properties, saying that Nick Denton cannot compete with them in any guise whatsoever, including keeping the Gawker name alive.
Okay, well, Ernest, I had completely forgotten about this next topic until you reminded me of it. Last week's announcement of NPR's decision to retire comments on its web pages, effective yesterday. Interestingly enough, though, this isn't because of misuse. This was because of a different decision entirely, different motivation.
Yeah, I mean, their motivation was, it was basically saying that it was only being used by a small percentage of the people who were actually reading the stories. And the people who were actually making these comments were sort of trying to drive the conversation in a direction that NPR or the people at NPR felt was not in the best interest of those it was trying to reach. So, I mean, I think that was the reason they did it. But it does open up the possibility that other news organizations will begin to look at their comment pages and say, okay, wait a minute, who are these comments coming from? And are they actually building up this sort of community that we can have these sort of conversations around these issues that these stories bring out? And I think what they're going to find out is that it's a very small percentage, and they're trying to drive the conversation for their particular agenda and not for a larger audience or a larger conversation.
I mean, NPR is not the first news organization to stop online comments, but they're probably the best known so far of the ones that have done that. And in some ways, I find it a bit depressing because, you know, idealistically, back in the day, we were all saying these comments were a great way for democracy and for audiences to be engaged and to have this sort of great debate about big issues. But what it's really devolved into in most instances, including at NPR, is a handful of people, a lot of times writing very arrogant, hateful, partisan rants, and that really doesn't help very much. The one thing I do like about NPR's decision is that they're not just saying, too bad, so sad, comments are gone. They're going to rely on their social media, which they have robust social media accounts on Twitter and Facebook. But also, they have other ways for people to comment. They have an ombudsman. Very few news organizations have that today. So no one can, I think, fairly say that NPR doesn't care about or give voice to their listeners.
But I think going in that direction gives them more control. And I think that is one of the things that other media operations are going to look at is going to social media and being able to monitor that and present it in a way for a larger audience that they can see that, hey, there are others out here who are concerned about this issue and here are their points of view in a way that's not demeaning and doesn't drive along these partisan lines. And I think that's where these comment sections are going. And that's one of the reasons why I think NPR, along with the fact that it was low numbers, moved in this direction.
Well, part of that low numbers thing, too, is that this is a financial decision as much as anything else, that NPR had been using a third-party application called Discuss to go ahead and publish those comments and do that using social media and Facebook integration. I'd like to ask you maybe for your predictions in relying on the social media. Part of this is going to be expecting individual reporters, individual anchors to engage more heavily personally as well with the audience. How do you see that going?
I mean, some do it already. Yeah. More of them need to do it if they're going to keep this up. But I also, there's only one thing I worry about with this move away from their own private online commenting sections is the fact that you're going to create this echo chamber on social media where it's very easy for you only to comment in a space where you're commenting with others who believe exactly the same things that you do.
Very true. We should mention KBIA.org is not yet a part of this. NPR is doing this with its national website and its national online products, and that the local member station's not yet a part of it. That could happen in the future. We don't know. But as our regular listeners know, and you'll hear it again at the end of the program today, we are, just like on the national level, on Facebook and on Twitter, and encourage people to get in contact with us in that way. Can we talk for a minute about Ryan Lochte and the bizarre story of what happened or didn't at the Rio gas station. So he wanted to save face, to keep his mom and the public from really knowing what went on that night. So he made up the story about being robbed at gunpoint. He lied to his family. He lied to police. But he lied to Matt Lauer. And that did not go over well with the NBC crew.
He lied. He lied to you.
Yeah.
He lied to Matt Lauer. Lied to his mom. He left his teammates hanging while he skedaddled.
He certainly lied about some details.
No, he lied. No, Billy.
Some details?
Billy,
not there was
some
no
details.
Robbery.
There was no robbery. There was no pullover. There was nothing. Nobody
there was no
cocked
gun,
a gun to his head.
Hold on.
He lied.
Okay, calm down. Listen, if a security guard is standing in front of you with a badge and is asking for money and you don't speak Portuguese.
There was a translator.
Right.
Well, the swimmers, Jimmy Fegan said there wasn't. So it's... There's a
but
different
the fact
story
is, but,
on that,
but if someone's
but,
saying, you'll give me money or you can't leave.
He lied.
Sure, he embellished
no,
that.
No.
Money unwillingly
embellish.
Came out of his pocket.
He lied. They were knocked out. He said they were. Their car was hit.
That's not true. That's
that
a lie. Well, gun to the head is a dirty Harry moment. Is a lie. That didn't happen. They weren't
so
sideswiped.
He created all of these moments to make himself look like.
Okay.
But, you know, I've stared them down in the face. It was, like you said, the dirty Harry moment. I mean, come on.
I don't know. I keep hearing Al Roker saying he lied, and I think of Lisa Simpson talking about her cat, Snowball. Here's a snippet of Ryan Lochte's apology, which aired in full on the Today Show on Monday.
I let my team down. And, you know, I wanted to be there. Like, I don't want them to think that I left and left them dry. Because, I mean, they were my teammates. I wanted to definitely be there. And I wanted to help out any way I could. And so I just wanted to make sure that they were home safe before I came out and talked.
And now that he has talked, now that the sponsors are dropping him, now that he's lost all of his street cred with the media and fans, couldn't possibly be anything lower than where it is right now. Most interesting thing about this story is how it came to light.
Yeah, I was surprised that an Australian reporter and his videographer just happened to stumble upon Lochte's mom while they were going from one story to the next, and she let it out, you know, that her son had been robbed at gunpoint, and then that's how the story developed. I felt for her mom, his mom, because it doesn't seem like she knew what was going on, and he left her hanging as much as anybody else. But, you know, the media aspect of this story that really amazes me is just how quickly, not just NBC, but especially NBC, fell for this. Mm-hmm. And I think it's like a lot of stories we talk about where this kind of problem comes up. The narrative was just too good. We wanted to believe it was true. It fit in with Rio's a dangerous place. And so we didn't vet it.
Yeah, that was the first thing I thought about was, wait a minute, you know, the Olympics have gone. I mean, they've had their issues, but nothing related to security. Mm-hmm. And now all of a sudden we have Olympic athletes robbed at gunpoint at a convenience store in Rio. And I mean, within less than 12 hours, this story had completely fallen apart. And I think Al Roker's right. He lied. And they flat out called it that way because they felt embarrassed about the fact that they didn't do due diligence. I'm talking about NBC didn't do due diligence on this.
So you say that, and we saw Al Roker and how he reacted to that. I mean, that was...
He was upset.
And a week later, it's almost comical how upset he was, frankly. But what does that tell us about how NBC goes about showcasing the athletes during their Olympic coverage, about how they cover them as people during the course of the week in terms of news coverage?
Well, I mean, what it says, I mean, they cover them the same way they always have. I mean, they're stars. Mm-hmm. They are the superhuman beings of sports in the Olympics, and it falls into the narrative and that sort of
stars
thing.
Stars are still flawed, though.
I understand that, but not the Olympic stars. They're not flawed when they're in the Olympics. They're flawed after they leave the Olympics. While the Olympics is going on, they are the shining light.
I have to say, too, that while I really enjoy seeing Al Roker take down Billy Bush, I don't think he was doing it because he was a defender of journalistic values. He was embarrassed because he's a Today Show lifer. He's a veteran. Here's Billy Bush, the new guy on the block who comes from Access Hollywood, had this exclusive interview. Ryan Lochte wants to go Hollywood. And so I think the motives for that exchange were, you know, less than pure.
It may not have been about defending journalism. It was about defending NBC and defending the Today Show.
Right. Well, defending the journalism part of the Today Show, which has been under fire for years because of the movement toward Access Hollywood, TMZ kind of things that they do on the show.
I will say, though, there was one sort of, there was one criticism of this whole thing that I found maybe a step too far. There are some critics who were saying that this basically showed, this whole Ryan Lochte story showed how the media were basically being racist and elitist about an Olympics that was in South America, where a country with predominantly people of color were running it. I mean, there are problems with crime in Rio. There are problems with environmental degradation. The AP did fabulous stories months in advance about water quality problems and all of that. The Zika virus is real. Those are stories you have to cover. But unfortunately, the Lochte story and how it was covered kind of plays into that ugly American narrative.
Well, the problem with it is that the initial story, the initial lie fit the narrative that Americans want to believe about Rio, mm-hmm. and certain parts of Latin America. And then when the lie was unveiled, then the other part of the story comes out where you start talking about, well, this is a bad boy Lochte we always knew about. And these stories go like, well, wait a minute. Why didn't you go to that narrative first as opposed to going to the narrative about Rio being an insecure place? That's the problem I have with it.
Okay, well, we have some more changes to talk about in the Trump campaign. Paul Manafort is out. Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway are in. Bannon comes to the campaign from the ultra-conservative Breitbart News. And Conway, a pollster who hasn't had a super prominent role in a campaign, at least at the level she's at right now previously. What does this change signal? I mean, it is the third one this summer.
I don't know. I mean, it's almost like he's changing top leadership on a weekly basis. I mean, some would say that this is a doubling down toward the right wing extreme part of the party, because that's where Breitbart mm-hmm. comes from. That's where she comes from and everyone else who's sort of moved into this. I also think that it's running away from Manafort and the problems he's having with his exposure to the Ukrainians and his operations there, and the fact that now you have a federal investigation against him. So I think Trump is sort of running away from that. I have no idea. And it also seems like they're running away from the Republican establishment and the RNC, even though they're taking a lot of their funds from the RNC. So, I mean, I just don't know where it's going right now.
It is kind of weird. I mean, Bannon is not the only high-profile conservative media personality who in the past week or two we found out is providing advice to the campaign.
And Sean Hannity.
Roger Ailes and Sean Hannity. And, you know, on the one hand, you could say it's doubling down on, you know, going after the base. But then the very next day after this happens, he comes out and has this kinder, gentler version of his immigration policy, maybe or maybe not. So I don't think it's easy to predict or explain anything that the Trump campaign is doing.
Well, and this is all happening at the same time, too. We spent a lot of time talking earlier this summer about former campaign manager Corey Lewandowski, who left under some interesting circumstances earlier in the summer after having been accused of putting his hands on several people, including a former Breitbart reporter. Going to work for CNN as a commentator. We find out in an FEC filing this week that in the month of July, he was collecting paychecks from both the Trump campaign and from CNN.
Well, it may have been something that was in his contract with Trump where he, you know, he was going to be paid out over a series of months and he was getting, you know, he was getting his money. And CNN, I wonder whether or not they did due diligence in their vetting of him before they brought him on, which was something that many with inside CNN were basically saying, hey, should we be doing this?
Yeah, I mean, I think the spotlight should fall on CNN. I mean, hey, Lewandowski's just getting his money. You know, good for him.
Good for him.
And the campaign is trying to say, well, this was just severance pay where he's not still on the payroll. But there are other reports that he's still providing behind the scenes advice to the campaign. And I just say that this fig leaf that CNN is using as their explanation for why they're keeping him on is getting smaller and smaller every day.
Business publications are pretty well known for their lists, 30 under 30, 40 under 40, most powerful, and so on. Last week, the St. Louis Business Journal and its sister publications across the country released its list of the most influential businesswomen. Props to the Business Journal for wanting to add a little bit of creativity to how it presented its list, for going a step beyond the other publications, which use standard head and shoulder portraits. But, and there's always a but, how they executed that creativity? Maybe not the best decision. The women are all posing with the shoes they say best define their personality. I can appreciate the effort here to humanize these women, to let their personalities shine through the portraits, but I'm having a really hard time with the idea of that humanization be channeled through fashion, through a gendered message that perhaps they may not have asked the same of their most powerful businessmen in St. Louis.
Yeah, when you sent this story and I read it, yeah. The first thing that popped into my mind was whoever was at the table when this was, somebody should have said, wait a minute, we need to rethink this. Something just doesn't seem right here. These kinds of stories really bother me because it makes me think that there's this sort of groupthink within news organizations where people may be thinking in the back of their mind something, but they're afraid to say it.
Well, and unfortunately, the person whose byline is on this feature and the person who wrote a good chunk of it is a former student of both mine and of Mike's. So somebody who also went through some of the programming in the curriculum that we teach in cross-cultural journalism and how to speak up in those situations.
Yeah, and I think, you know, she is learning mm-hmm. a very important lesson from what happened here. But I also think that she was probably the low person in that hierarchy because there's at least one senior editor, a male, who was quoted when being interviewed by the Riverfront Times as saying, well, you know, we talked about it in the newsroom and there were some people who kind of, you know, complained about it. But, you know, this was really the right thing. And as the Riverfront Times pointed out, maybe you should listen to your newsroom in the future and you won't do stupid things like
this.
Well,
to me, it's one of those things we say in the class all the time. It's not what you meant to do, it's what you did.
It's what you're
doing. You know, and this is an example you use in class. I mean, this is what you put in the textbook when you say, this is what you don't want to do. And it goes back to what you just said. Listen to the people in your newsroom. Sometimes they're right.
And I heard some people arguing, you know, well, but these were top executives. If they didn't want to do this, they didn't have to do this. But
yeah,
I think that's kind of simplistic.
And what if they're not, and they'd end up not being included in the feature because right. they aren't playing along.
Right.
Well, before we go, I want to take a moment to remember George Curry, a legendary political and civil rights journalist. Curry died this weekend at the age of 69. He started his career reporting for Sports Illustrated and the St. Louis Dispatch, and in the 1990s was the editor of Emerge with the tagline Black America's News Magazine. In 1993, there was a cover of that magazine that depicted an image of then Supreme Court nominee Clarence Thomas wearing an Aunt Jemima-style handkerchief next to the word betrayed. Champion of the black press lost.
Yes, I know Mike George Curry for a while when I first got into journalism, mm-hmm. And I was my early years in the National Association of Black Journalists, ran into George at many of the conferences and actually worked with him on a conference in Houston, and he was always a champion of the causes that within the African American community that many of the mainstream newspapers didn't want to pay attention to. So I think I know he's going to be sorely missed as a champion for the African American community.
Okay, well, we're out of time for today. You can read more about the topics we talked about on our links blog. That's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is @viewsonkbia. Want to catch our program again or find it in new ways? We're available online at kbia.org, on YouTube, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts, including the NPR One app. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave us comments, questions, see what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to RJI's Travis McMillan for directing today's show, to KBIA's Pat Akers for handling the audio for us, and Megan Sheets, our associate producer. I'm Amy Simons. I will be back here next week with Mike, Ernest, and we will have another edition of Views of the News.